This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Will, and we are continuing in the life of Abraham. Today, we're going to be talking about Genesis 13. And so in our last episode, we talked about how Abraham was called, how God comes to this person who's being raised up in a pagan land and a home that's worshiping pagan gods. And Abraham would have had all of these pressures to have children, you know, from his name meaning exalted father, to being in a town that has a fertility god, Nana, who is all about that. Everything about this would have been pressuring to have children, and yet his wife is barren, which means he's bearing the shame religiously in his family, in his town, and just culturally. That was a big emphasis in the ancient world. So God comes to him and he says, hey, I want you to leave all of that, follow after me, and I will make you a great nation. I'll give you lots of kids. I'm going to make your name great. You've been walking around in shame, feeling the weight of this. Let me make your name great. I'll protect you. I'll bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. And oh, by the way, the coup de grace of all promises, through you, through your line, through your descendants, I am going to bless all nations, all families on the face of the earth. Through you, in other words, is going to come the Savior of the world. And you see Abraham, who shows this incredible faith where he says, I'm in, and he leaves everything. And you're like, man, this guy is incredible. And you get 10 verses into chapter 12, and all of a sudden, when famine comes,
he's out.
So notice, because today you're going to see the opposite of that. When famine comes and he can't make sense of the circumstances, and it's like, wait a minute, God, you promised me a land and it's barren, and you promised me kids, but my wife is barren. Like, the circumstances don't add up. He bails and goes down to Egypt and looks for provision from the hand of Pharaoh. And in the process, if you remember, he betrays his wife. And he says, yeah, pretend like you're my sister, let Pharaoh have you, you know, but it'll go well for me. I don't want to die for you. And you see this shameful side of Abraham. We talked about how God is the only hero in this story, and God still chases them, redeems them, protects them. And so now, as we enter into chapter 13, we're dealing with the aftermath of chapter 12.
Yeah, and 13 is fascinating. I mean, as we get into it, blessings on blessings on blessings and how they go wrong.
Yeah, that's right. So if 12 was, all right, you're going to face famine. Well, how are you going to deal with my promises in the midst of famine? And Abraham fails. So 13, it's like, okay, well, let's see. The people of God fail in the middle of the famine. They don't trust God. They run down to Egypt, the land of death and bondage, and the serpent-crowned king. When we get to 13, it's like, okay, well, here's blessing after blessing after blessing. How are you going to handle this? And what you find out is humanity,
we don't do extremes well.
We win again, you know, like, and they mess up again. And so starting in verse 1, it says, so Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev. Now, remember, the Negev's in the southern part of Israel. The word literally means desert. So this is not a super fertile place. It says, with his wife and everything that he had, because he walks out of Egypt. Do you remember what he was getting?
All the livestock.
Oxen, and donkeys, yeah, stuff. And camels, and male servants, and female servants. And, I mean, he leaves Egypt absolutely loaded from Pharaoh. And it says Abraham had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and in gold. And from the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. So it's after the mess. And we talked about this in our last episode, but it's after the mess where you've just betrayed God, you've just betrayed your wife, and the Lord shows kindness to you, that Abraham bounces around, but ultimately he comes back home to the place where he had that worship encounter with
God. Yeah, this last place he really trusted God.
Yeah. Do you have places like that where it's like, it just seems like when I go there, I feel closer with God?
Yeah. I like the description of, what is that? The Celts that called them the thin places on this earth.
Yeah.
Like this whole idea that like there are places that for each of us, we have a routine that's better. I think, I mean, mine's, I don't know. Where are yours?
I have my family owns a place up in northern Florida that's on a lake.
Okay.
It's got a dock, and like that's always been my place. Like when I've written and done stuff like that, when I go there, I just feel closer with God. You know, our church has a prayer house that's another place where it's like when I enter in there, like it feels sacred to me, place, like it's easier to connect with God for whatever reason. And when you call it a thin place, like the idea behind that is, you know, you have the earthly dimension down here, you have a heavenly dimension, the place where the separation is the thinnest is the idea where it doesn't take much to feel like you're in the throne room of God or access to the heavenly realm. But this is Abraham's place. He's like, I'm going back there because that's the last time I had real worship. That place was special. And he goes there and he starts calling on the name of the Lord.
And I like that the Old Testament does that, because I think, so my place has happened because of experience. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Old Testament, Abraham's just like, no, this is going to be the place where I'm going to experience God.
Yeah.
It's not I have. It's like, no, this is it. I'm forcing this to be the place, which I think I need more of in my life. Mm-hmm. Not just waiting for this like magical moment to arrive. And it does sometimes, but sometimes it definitely does not. So it's saying to my own heart, like, no, we're going to worship God here.
Mm-hmm. And the Old Testament, one of the interesting things about like Jewish customs, the law, is it set up all of these routines and things that you were to do and feasts and holidays and things like that. And we look back at that and we go, okay, the gospel's freed us from all that. Like, we don't need that for salvation. And that's 100% true. Like, you don't have to do it to earn God's favor. But the flip side of that is they were wise enough to recognize that in and of ourselves, like, we wonder, like, we're short-sighted. So it's good to have, like, hooks where you come back and go, okay, no, this is going to be a pattern in my life, a discipline in my life, because otherwise I'm too easily distracted. I'll never show up for God. Like, I need these things, like the Sabbath, that call me back and put me in front of the Lord so that he can do business with me. Otherwise, I'll just ignore him and go about my self-absorbed life.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that, by the way, long before Abram comes back to the altar to call on the name of the Lord's already rescued him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Abraham wasn't in Egypt going, Lord, we need you. Come rescue us. Please, God. Like, God rescues him.
He was counting his livestock.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Look how wealthy I'm getting. But now it's like he calls on the name of the Lord and just this tremendous amount of blessing follows. So who is Lot in this story? Just let's recap who Lot is, because he comes up out of Egypt with his wife, with all the wealth, and Lot's coming with him. So you remember who Lot is?
Yeah, it's the nephew of a dead bro. I mean, he's Abraham's nephew.
Yep.
His brother has died, Haran. That's his son. And it's kind of a step of faith for Lot, too, right, in all this?
Oh, for sure.
Like, we think, like, oh, Abram, he is making a faithful decision, but Lot, you're like, promise isn't for me.
That's right.
But I got to hook up with you, though.
But not only is the priest, so think about this from Lot's perspective. So not only is the promise not for you, but the promise is, right now, if Abraham dies, guess who gets it all?
Lot.
Like, Lot is it. He's basically the surrogate son. He's the nephew. There's no living heir for Abraham's wealth. So if Abraham dies, it's all Lot's. But what is God's promise to Abraham? You're going to have a son, and it's going to be through him that this great nation comes, which means if you have a son, Abraham,
Lot doesn't matter at all.
Yeah. Guess where the inheritance goes? So this promise is kind of working against Lot. And rather than being like, hooray, God is going to do a great work of redemption through you and your line, Abraham, and I'm glad to be a part of it, you got to wonder if Lot is over there. And by the way, we know that Lot is a redeemed character later. The New Testament tells us that he's redeemed, but he's got a lot of stumbles.
Righteous Lot.
Yeah, well, but he's got a lot of stumbles on the way of being righteous Lot, just like Abraham has a lot of stumbles on the way to being Father Abraham. But step into the mindset of Lot. It's like, man, if God makes good on his promise, I lose all of this.
But there is, whoever blesses Abram will be blessed. So you're like,
right,
let me get on board with that.
And you see that in the story. So Lot hangs with Abraham, and as Abraham's wealth begins to multiply and Lot is hanging around in his household, as we're going to see, Lot becomes tremendously wealthy.
Attaboy, Lot.
So this is where we pick up. And in verse 5, we're told, now Lot, who is moving about with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents. But the land could not support them while they stayed together, for possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herders and Lot's. The Canaanites and the Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. So what this is doing is it's setting up like, okay, there's scarcity. There's only so much land. The Canaanites, the Perizzites are there. They, you know, really have claim to the land. And so Abram's footprint and Lot's footprints, they're both expanding because God is blessing their socks off. And what happens? So in famine, Abram's like, really, God? Like, I'm going to Egypt. But now in blessing, this is what we're to understand here. Like, the Bible is teaching us that God says, okay, famine, you didn't do so hot.
Yes.
Now I'm going to bless your socks off. You're going to become so wealthy. There's going to be such an abundance. Is that going to be good for you? And what's the answer?
Never is.
No. Like, you look at what happens here is they're so blessed that it causes them to fight. Like, again, why are they fighting?
Their possessions were so great.
God bless their socks off. So, like, anytime you look, there's a truth in the Bible that whenever wealth becomes your ultimate pursuit, like, it's idolatry, you're chasing after God and it'll enslave you. When the Bible comes to you and it says your greatest purpose in life, Jesus says, when they ask him, what are the greatest commandments for humanity to follow? What does he say? It is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to love your neighbor as yourself. What is not in that equation? Get more stuff.
Yeah.
Store it up. Get so much wealth and blessing and everything else that arises. And notice what happens when the wealth comes, which they could use to bless other people. They could use for a million different things. Rather than saying, you know what, like, our relationship is most important, for Lot to say, you know what, Uncle Abraham, like, I'll sacrifice the stuff to make sure that our relationship stays firm and that we can stay together. What is the posture here? My stuff is more important than my relationship with you. And so we're going to fight. And if we don't find a solution, this relationship is over.
Yeah, it makes them enemies of each other.
And so we don't do well in the famines. We don't do well in the blessings. And so that's what we're going to learn in this particular passage.
And you're looking for the mature person in all of these stories. Mm-hmm. You're looking for someone to come in like, oh, my herders are fighting. Abraham is going to be the man of reason. Be like, guys, we shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
At all turns throughout this story, you're like, somebody be the adult here.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it never happens.
Yeah, and we read right past it, and we don't see what the message is here, that wealth actually is dangerous to relationships. You know, like, there's an old Puritan that said, he's got a great line, religion begat prosperity. In other words, like, chasing after God will bring you blessing. It gives birth to blessing is the idea. But then the blessing devours your relationship with God. And you walk away from it because all of a sudden you start thinking, wow, look at all this stuff. I'm secure in and of myself. Like, I can do it all. And you start walking away from God's design and what he wants. And in this story, like, I think it's helpful. What do you think Jesus would have done in this situation? Like, and I got to believe that if he's in Lot's shoes, he says, the possessions are secondary. My relationship with you is more important. And if it's Abraham, like, I mean, Lot's being kind of rebellious here. He's supposed to be under the authority of this, you know, Abraham, who's the elder here. But yet both of them are willing to seem willing to sacrifice the relationship for the stuff. And yeah, there's a warning in this. And you're going to see, because of this, Lot is later on going to get into lots of trouble. In the next chapter, Lot's going to find himself in big trouble because he chooses wealth over Abram. And Abram's going to rescue him. But when the Bible comes to us and says, you know what, your relationship with God is the most important thing in your life. It should be your top priority. And then the second after that is to love your neighbor as yourself. The reason why it does that is those are the only two things that you have in your life that are eternal in their consequences and implications.
Yep.
Right? Like, so I can have a million in my flocks. I can have a million camels and donkeys and all, you name it. They all go away. My bank account doesn't follow me into the grave.
Yeah, they die or I die.
Right? Like, death is going to swallow it all. All of my bank accounts and my houses and cars and my career. In 200 years, nobody's going to know my name, almost certainly. Like, I don't remember who my great-grandfather is. I don't know any of that stuff. It's like they just become forgotten in history. You know, so much of this, like, you live and you slave as though your paycheck is everything and climbing the ladder and running the corporate hamster wheel and everything else. And we live as though that's chief priority, and we kind of deprioritize our family and those that are precious to us, the people in our lives, to chase after these, you know, little gods in our life. And we end up enslaved to them, and we sacrifice the things, the only things that are eternally significant. What you do for God will have implications in your life that go on forever. I think that's obvious, right? But there's only, the only other thing in your life that's everlasting is the souls of those around you. The stuff perishes. The wealth perishes. Everything else goes away. And so if you have true wisdom and you see the commands of Jesus, love God and love others, those are the only things that matter forever. So pour your life into those. If you have wealth, what should you use your wealth to do? To honor God and to honor and to take care of others, your neighbors. That's how that wealth becomes eternally significant. And both, it seems to me, both Lot and Abraham in this moment are like, more, more. We need to build bigger barns. We need more, more, more. You're getting in my way. You know what? Like, we don't like each other. We're going to fight rather than the blessing being a blessing to others. It becomes a blessing that's, I need more. I need more. And you're getting in my way of more. And it's like, that's kind of gross, right? So here, not a great lap for Abram and Lot here.
No, it's that C.S. Lewis quote that is, I'll jack it up, but it's like, you've never met a mere mortal. Like, the people you work with, the people you play with, the people you walk around with, all of their souls are eternal. Like, they're going to face God one day, just like I am. And that's the question that matters. And did I do anything to help them for that moment?
That's right. I mean, it really is. I mean, when you walk in the Christian faith and the realities that are at play here, like, it's convicting, it's humbling, it's exhilarating. But think about the purpose of life. It's not just a rat race so that you can
get to the end.
Get more trinkets, right? Like, this is weighty. It's beautiful. It's powerful. Like, the impact you could have on an everlasting soul just by being faithful to the Lord, and to use your wealth and generosity rather than storing up for yourself. Like, this is another story that's like, yeah, this doesn't go well when you chase after money. Didn't go well with famine because you don't trust God in the famine, but it doesn't go well in blessing. Like, you don't do well at either of these.
Yeah.
Famine or blessing, you don't do well at them. But here's another one of the things that I find interesting in my life. When do you draw nearest to the Lord? Is it in the midst of the great abundance, or is it in the midst of the famines?
Well, me, it's the famines.
Yeah, that's, I think that's true of everyone. So, that, you know, like, I think God gives us those moments because he strips away all of our other idols and things that we can lean on, and he shows himself to be sufficient for us. Those are the moments where you have the sweetest worship, is when you're wondering, how's this going to work out? And the only thing that you have to grab hold of is the Lord. But when everything is great and the wealth is pouring in and the blessings are all there, and we forget God. It's like, so if you're a God, I mean, you think about it. I've thought about this. Like, if I'm God and I love my people and I really want their attention and I really want to have a relationship with them, but the only time they ever look at me is when
things are going
they
bad.
Face yeah. calamity.
Just be throwing down calamities.
Right? Like, if the best thing for you is to have a relationship with me, but you only have a relationship with me when there's calamity, a loving God
brings calamity.
Brings calamity. Because that's where we actually grow and realize what's best for us. It's not in the blessings. It's not in the huge herds and the enormous flocks and the wealth that's pouring out that we don't have enough room for. It's him.
Yeah. And I love this wisdom from Proverbs 30. Verse 9, it says this. The NLT version of Proverbs 39 says this: "For if I grow rich, I may deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' And if I am too poor, I may steal and thus insult God's holy name." So it's like saying, don't give me the two extremes, God. I can't handle being wealthy because I'm just going to say, I don't need you, God. but also don't cause me to sin in my poverty. It's like, give me the golden mean of it all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like, okay, that's true. That's what I need. Like, yeah. I'm not good in either extreme. Like, if God gave me too much money, I don't know what would happen. But in poverty, the same thing. So it's like, okay, this makes sense.
So this is what a lot of people don't know, is that from that passage that you just quoted, it's where Jesus picks up in his, the Lord's Prayer, when he's teaching his people how mm-hmm. to pray, and he says, give us this day our daily bread. He's quoting that proverb, which is, so when you pray, give us this day our daily bread in the Lord's Prayer, what you're actively praying is, don't leave me starving,
yeah.
but don't give me wealth.
Don't give me enough for even tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that when you pray the Lord's Prayer, you're asking God not to make you wealthy. You're asking for daily bread, because that prayer is a recognition that if you gave me too much, I'd forget about you. Do you still want to pray that?
Not as often.
Right? So there's a lot of that, because there's good things get in the way of the most important things. You know, we live in South Florida, tremendously wealthy area.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of despair and depression you see because of the pursuit of wealth and all of those things is higher in areas of great wealth.
Yeah.
You know, I have a theory, because I've done a number of suicide funerals as a pastor, you know, more than 10. They're awful. I hate them. They're truly sad and tragic. But one of the things that I noticed in life is that it's rarely the people in the middle that I've had to do a suicide funeral for. They're the people that you look at and you're like, man, there's a lot of suffering in their life, and they've got mental issues and things like that. And their life was seemed like one tragedy and one hardship after another, and they finally had enough. So on that end of the bell curve. But the other ones are all on this side. It's the person that had it all, that was the CEO, that has the great family and the huge house and the best cars and the huge bank accounts and everything else. And you're like, how does that work? Like, everybody's like, they seem to have it all. Like, why would they do this? And the reality is once you chase all that down, and famous people and wealthy people will tell you this, like, once you get it, once you chase down your dream and you wrestle it to the ground and you've got all the money you could ever deal with and all the fame you could ever deal with, guess what? It's not enough. But without God, it's like, what else is there to chase? There's yeah. nothing left for me. This feels empty, and this is the only way I know to medicate myself.
Mm.
What's left for me? Like, there's only despair. And so God has wired us to have hearts where he is the one that satisfies. Like, in the famine, guess who it is that will give you meaning and purpose and fulfillment? It is the Lord. He is the bread of life. And in the abundance, the only one that can satisfy you. Your bank account never will. The yachts, the houses, the fame, never, ever will. There is only one who can satisfy that infinite hole that's always growing and demanding more, that's in the middle of your heart. And the only thing that can satisfy, it's an infinite God that you'll never exhaust. There's always more of him to enjoy. And I think it's fascinating that the two most depressive books of scripture to me are Ecclesiastes and Job.
Yeah.
You know, here you have Job, who had everything and lost it all. And it's like, man, and his health and everything else, and he loses loved ones. And you're like, man, that guy's seriously suffering. And you get why he says, I don't want to live anymore.
Hmm.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you read the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's a guy who's got more wealth than he knows what to do with, more wisdom, more wives, more power, more fame, more this. And the whole book is like, I've got it all. And it's utterly meaningless. It's utterly empty. And that guy says, I don't want to do this anymore. I wished I was never born. And you're like, wait, well, so if utter suffering and loss leads you there, and utter wealth and blessing leads you there, it's telling you your hope is not in the stuff of this world. You need something beyond the world. You need the Lord. He's the only one that can satisfy. And here again, Abraham is going to have to learn that lesson.
And with all that, I think I really respect more the people who have found earthly wealth and have managed it and stewarded it well, to the point of saying, okay, like, 'cause we know a lot of guys who have done this
yeah.
well in a way, and I respect them so much, because I look at myself and I'm like, I don't know if I would have done that well.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a respect to being like, okay, it's not being wealthy is not the issue. It's, you know, the, as the Bible says, the love of money is the root of all evil.
But you look at them that have great means that then use their wealth to help the downtrodden, to spread the gospel, to help women in crisis pregnancies, to help the homeless. And they fund these ministries so that good can be done in the name of Christ. And they find great joy in their generosity, where the people that are hoarding up the acorns, it's like, dude, you're miserable.
Yeah,
like, so somebody that can tame that greed and use their possessions to honor the Lord, it's a blessed life. It really is. And it's fun. Generosity is a fun thing. So Abraham, in the middle of this, like, there's quarreling. We're too blessed. We can't handle each other. Abraham says to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me or between your herders or mine, for we are close relatives. So he wants peace, but he's not going to get rid of his money to get it. It's not the whole land before you. Let's part company. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go to the left. And so he comes up with this peacemaker solution, which is admirable. It's not just, hey, I'm in charge here. You know, I'm taking it all. Verse 10, it says, Lot looked around, and he saw the whole plain of the Jordan toward Zoar was well watered. So if you're looking at a map, Galilee is a sea in the north. The Jordan River runs out of Galilee down into the Dead Sea. And so just north of where the Dead Sea is what he's talking about. And the Jordan runs and the irrigation's happening. And man, the greenery just comes to life right around the Jordan. It's like the Garden of the Lord. So what is that saying? What's the Garden of the Lord?
Eden.
It's Eden. So Lot's looking over there and he's like, man, that looks like Eden. It looks like the land of Egypt. And so Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. And the two men parted company. So why does Lot choose that land?
Look good to the eyes.
Man, that looks like there's a lot of wealth over there.
It's never been a good sign in the Bible.
No, it hasn't. And so he's like, I'm going to chase after that. And it says Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot moved among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. So they would have known this. They've been in the territory long enough to where they know where to go, where not to go. They've heard the rumors of what's going on in Sodom. So Abraham's like, look, you pick the direction. And you're sitting here thinking, like, wait a minute. First, God has promised you this land, Abraham. Like, it's not yours to give away to Lot. Like, but here you have Abraham trying to negotiate with God's promise. But what's interesting to me is Lot sees this promised land, right? But he looks over there, and there's a really wealthy city where they hate God. Where they, I mean, they're sinning greatly. It's an awful place. But there's money there. Will I walk away from this covenant family, this place that God has blessed, looking over there, seeing the Garden of Eden, where they hate God, but there's money? And what does he choose? He chooses to go to the garden. And what's fascinating about this is the Bible is presenting something to you where Abraham stays in the land that's not quite as good, right?
To the eye.
To the eye.
Future, different.
But God's there. This is where I meet with God. This is where my altar is. This is where I call upon the name of the Lord. Over there, something that's like the Garden of Eden, but God's not there. And Lot's like, I'll take the wealth.
Yeah.
Like, give me the path that's easy street. I don't care if God's there or not. And we know how that story is going to turn out in the next chapter, right? Like, this is a place of great blessing materially. But it's a spiritual wasteland that God will destroy, that's filled with utter wickedness. And you see it actually corrupt Lot and his family. And Lot will pay a great price for picking Eden without God. And this is sending a message that you might think there's a paradise, but if God's not there, guess what? It's not paradise. It'll be a cursing to you. If you could look at the best job offer in the world, it's like the Garden of the Lord. Look at it. Look at the salary and the benefits and everything else. But it's going to require you to walk away from all the things that God has told you to chase, like a relationship with him and time with him and time with your family and time with your kids and time with your wife. And you can chase the paradise and walk away from the sacred, and it will be a curse to you. That Eden, if God's not there, becomes an absolute curse. And so it's all about how you prioritize things, right? Like, if I'm looking at the land of Zoar, where it's well watered like the garden of the Lord, but God's not there, I don't want any part of it. Because I know how that story ends every time. Every time I've chased the world's idea of paradise, where God is, you know, the casualty, it always ends bad. Always ends bad. And that's where our culture is today. Like, we train up our kids even to see, oh, this is the definition of success. You should go there because it's got more wealth and it's got this. And this is a Fortune 500 company and you should chase after that. And we train them up to believe all the wrong priorities. And we're, you know, we're shocked
when they do.
We're shocked when their lives are falling apart. And we have the most anxious, depressed, hopeless, desperate generation that social sciences have ever measured.
Yeah, I think Barna, who does research about the next generation, did a great study about, okay, what do we see our children, specifically Gen Z, prioritizing? Because what they prioritize, like you're saying, is that's going to be their life. Okay, so at the top of their list, number one, finish my education, start a career, become financially independent, follow my dreams, enjoy life before I have the responsibilities of being an adult, find out who I am, travel to other countries, and then finally, at number eight, with only 20%, people wanting to accomplish this before 30 is getting married. Then at 16% it's become more spiritually mature. Wow. At 12% it's become a parent. At 9% it's care for the poor and needy. And wow. So the bottom four is what we would say we care about. It's fully inverted.
I mean, if you were to look at the heart of God and what he wants for humanity, you could almost take that list and flip it, and that would be what's most important to God. A life of blessing, a life that's eternally significant would be wife, kids, caring for the poor, being charitable, having good spiritual health.
Yeah, caring about your spiritual maturity.
Like, those are at the very bottom. And we wonder why this generation is falling apart. Like, gosh, I mean, that's sad to read, but we've trained them up to believe this. Like, they go through school and it's like, you got to get into the best college and you got to get the best job. And, you know, you can't have just an ordinary laborer job. You need to be the CEO. And if you don't, then your life doesn't amount to anything. And look at this person's Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all the ways that we project what success is, and nobody measures up to it. And by the way, when you do measure up to it, it's empty and you're depressed and miserable anyway, because you've neglected the things that are meant to spiritually feed you. And it's crippling. Like, I remember when my son, who's now a junior in high school, this was such a formative thing for me as a Christian dad. But when he was in fifth grade, so we're talking 10-year-old.
Yes.
10 years old. We're sitting in the living room. I got the TV on. I'm working on something. He's over there doing something. And just out of the blue, I hear him say, "Dad, I don't think I'm going to be successful in life." And it was like record, like, where in the world does a 10-year-old...
Why would you ever even think of that?
And fifth grade feel like his life is going to be meaningless. And this isn't a Christian home. I talk about this all the time, identity and purpose and all that. And so I just paused for a moment and I was like, hold on, whoa, hold on. Say that again. I don't think I'm going to be successful in life. And I said, Caleb, I want you... tell me what that means. Like, I want you to tell me your definition. What is a successful life? You tell me what that looks like. And he's like, well, you know, like, I might not be as smart as some of the other classmates. I don't know that I'm going to be able to get into the good colleges. I don't know that I'll ever be able to get a job that pays a lot of money. I don't know that and he starts listing out all these things that are precisely that garbage.
Yeah.
The world's priorities. And I said, hold on a minute, Caleb. Like, okay, that's the way this world defines success. But let me tell you how God defines success. And we walked through this whole conversation about what it means to love others and to love him and to do things with integrity and to be upright and to love, right? Those are the big commands. I said, buddy, you do that in spades. I'd take you over anybody else in your grade level when it comes to that stuff. And that's how God defines success. And by the way, that's what's eternally significant. All the stuff that you just defined, even though I disagree with the fact of whether you could accomplish it or not, who cares?
Yeah.
If you've got these things, that is a successful life. And buddy, you got that. And I'll tell you, the difference in spirit, like, he was dancing on sunshine at the end of that conversation. And I thought, man, if that's in my own home where we talk about these things a lot, you know, just needing that reminder, because gosh, I need that because I define my success in life.
Here we are talking a podcast about it. Gosh. We're the first offenders.
Bad. So it's like we need that constant reminder that our evaluation of life and what makes life worth living and what makes life a success is radically different than the way that Babel would define the success of a life. And we've got to preach this to ourselves, and we've got to preach it to our kids, because Abraham and Lot scurrying around to get more and more and more while they're dismissing each other so they can have bigger territories and more wealth, like, that's not good.
Yeah.
That's not the mark of a success. This is a point of shame in this family that's ripped apart so they can chase more blessing. Gross. Like, this is a warning to us that, okay, in famine, you trust God. Yeah. You don't run to Egypt. Okay, well, in blessing, you use your blessing to bless your brother and your nephew and those that are around you. You don't forsake people for the pursuit of stuff.
Yeah, one of my newer life filters is when we were going through Galatians as a church, and Tom would always talk about, like, what's the opinion of heaven? You know, he's mostly talking about from our identity's sake, but now I use that as, like, a filter, just like a decision-making filter. Like, okay, well, you have options here. What would the opinion of heaven say is your best option?
That's good.
I'm like, oh, that's a much different perspective than, because mostly what's good for Will and what's the opinion of heaven isn't always in line with each other, which is, like, it's tough, but it's true.
Yeah, I mean, you think about this in practical terms, you know, let's fast forward, you know, 20 years and your daughter comes to you and she says, you know, Dad, I've got two options in front of me. One is going to be a life of very meager ends, but it's going to be in a place where it's wholesome and there's love and the people trust God. And, you know, it might be harder and I might have to pinch pennies and, you know, do all those things. Or, gosh, there's this job over here that would, I'd make millions and I would get all the stuff and everything else, but it's in an industry and in a location that's utterly disgusting and will rot my soul. All the influences around me are going to tear me down and make me feel like a commodity. Which one of those would you want your daughter to chase?
I mean, the first one, no doubt.
Right? So why do we think any different for ourselves? Why do we think that God would have anything different for us? Like, we should be chasing that which is sacred to him, that which is wholesome to him, and trust. Just like you would want that for your daughter, that's what he wants for us, right? The world's definitions of success get these two into big trouble.
Because they got
it. We're going to see in the next chapter.
And they hate each other.
Yeah, right? So lay that stuff down as the ultimate thing that defines our lives.
Yeah, and this is
and
not,
love one another.
And like we've been talking, this is not a casual relationship between Abraham and Lot. Both of them need each other in a way that, like, Abraham has leaned on him as his son for a long time. I mean, Lot's father's dead, and all he has is his uncle taking care of him. So, I mean, there's real relationship here. This is not just, oh, these two are friends and business partners, and this all happened, and it tore each other apart. No, this is, like, so sad for Abraham for Lot to say, I'm out.
Yeah, think about Abraham leaving his father's household. Lot was like, I'm going with him. I throw my lot in with him. I'm not going to walk away from Abram now to stay in my grandfather's house with my, you know, uncle that's still living. Like, he says, all right, I'm with you. And they just run into blessing, and it tears it all apart.
And you got to be like, Abram.
Wow.
This isn't in the text.
So the question is, if God knew that blessing would make us rotten, should he ever give us blessing? And I think about it that way, because we're quick to blame him for the famine and be like, oh, why would God do
famine's
that?
Famine's always like, you did this, God.
But if blessings destroy make us rotten to each other, why would he give us wealth? He just keeps blessing us, right?
Yeah.
And we keep doing bad in the famine and keep doing bad in the blessings. And you know what? He's there to chase after us to pick up the pieces. And by the way, he will redeem Abraham from this, and he will redeem Lot from this.
Yeah. Just another learning lesson for us.
So again, who's the hero?
Not these two.
It's not these two. It's the God that when they screw up and they do it wrong, the God who's chasing after them again. And it's right after Abram's going back to the altar so he can praise God there again. And he falls into this and it's like, gosh, I can relate to this guy. You know, it's like right in the middle of the praise, like a day later. It's like right after church, you do something stupid or you get angry with your kids or whatever. And it's like, I just came from worshiping a God who's so patient with me and calls me his son and makes things new every morning. And my patience with my kid when they do something stupid, like what is wrong with me? But that's how we're wired. And what's God's posture when we lean away? He's always leaning after us, chasing after us. He's the hero of all this. He's really wonderful and incredibly patient. Like, it's stunning that he puts up with us and doesn't just put up with us, dotes on us.
The long suffering of God's a real thing.
Wow. Because we're Abraham. You know, it's interesting. So continuing on from there, in verse 14, you have Lot, who's like, oh, wealth over there, even though they're rotten to the core and it's one of the most wicked places on the surface of the earth. I want to go over there. And so Abram loses the one descendant he had to pass it, blood relative that he had to pass it all down to. And it says the Lord said to him, because you got to imagine this is sad for Abram. Like, what now?
I don't know if this is
all of my eggs are in this basket.
Biblical truth, but I feel like Abraham's invitation to Lot was one that he wanted to be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he wanted the love of Lot to say, no, Uncle Abraham, look at what you've done for me. Look at how far we've came. Look at everything I have purely because of you. And you want him just to be like, none of this matters. And yet he's like, I'm going over there. See you later. Like, just ripping off a bandit.
Yeah. You know, Abram doesn't go as far as Jesus, but notice what the subtle message to Lot is: peace with you matters more to me than which land I get.
Yeah, at least he tried.
Yeah. It's not, you know, I'll leave everything, which is the wild, radical love of Jesus, where it's like, I'll go from being God who has it all and come to being homeless so that I can restore a relationship with you. Abram doesn't go that far. That's radical love. But at least he says, hey, I want peace with you. Like, you pick the land.
What would it take?
Yeah. And Lot, punk that he is, who will ultimately be redeemed and called righteous Lot in the New Testament, which is wild. We haven't even gotten to the worst part.
Yeah, this is not his rock bottom.
Yeah. But you see, like, God can redeem him too, you know? This stubborn little self-entitled brat that treats his uncle this way, like, who's riding on his coattail of blessing. It's like, everything you've got is because of me, and yet Abraham lets him go, you know? Wild story. So anyway, we get into verse 14, and it says, the Lord said to Abram after Lot had parted from him, again, a big blow to Abram, this last blood relative who's, if God doesn't come through on the promise of a child, there's no one left. And he says, look around from where you are, to the north, to the south, to the east and west. All the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring forever. So it's right in the middle of Abraham's moment here that God comes, and what's the medicine? I'm going to repeat the promise to you.
Yeah, just listen again.
Listen, I'm giving you this land. I'm giving you offspring. He says, I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth. You think you just lost your one last blood relative? Like, I'm going to make your offspring like the dust of the earth. Like, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. It's going to be so many. Like, imagine trying to count dust.
I mean,
like,
I'm thinking about it. I can't.
It's absurd to even think about, right? Like, and he's like, that's how many descendants you're going to have. So go walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I'm giving it to you. I want you to do an object lesson. It's not just going to be like, think about it. I want you to walk. And that's going to take you days. And I want you to walk the length and breadth of the land, and the whole time here, I want you to be thinking on my promise. This is going to belong to your kids. And as you're walking and meditating on this days-long practice, here's God doing a discipline again. Do nothing but think about this promise. Abraham, eventually you're going to believe this with your whole heart. Eventually it's going to get down into your bones, even despite all these failures and everything else along the way where you're bumping your head and you're forgetting it all. You're going to remember it. Go walk. It's all yours. It's all yours.
And that's a tip for us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Piper says it best, like, preach it to yourself until your heart, like, sings with joy that you actually believe the gospel.
Yeah.
Like, it is something that we have to learn to do. It's a muscle we flex. Like, hey, everything I see right now everything Abraham sees is not promise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not seen his wife get pregnant. He's not seen people leave the land and allow him to enter in. And yet God's like, no, you got to go preach these promises to yourself till you really believe.
Yeah, and you got to get them in your bones, like, yeah, so that when the moment of crisis or when the crucible comes, it's there and you can draw on it. Laura and I talk about this where it's like, I have never had my emotions rescue my mind from something, but I have my mind rescue my emotions all the time, mm-hmm, where it's like, I feel this way. And then I stop and I go, well, hold on a minute. What would God say to this? God says, and this is who I am in his sight. And all of a sudden I can calm my emotions with what I have filled my faith and my mind with. It rescues me. And what God is saying is, I want you to get this so burned into your brain. Walk the land. I want you to remember it all. I want you to remember all of this. I want it to be seared deep into your heart to where the next time the crucible comes, this is not wasted. It's not a flash in the pan moment, yes, where I just give a promise. I want you to walk it out. I want you to remember it. So Abraham went to live near the great trees of Mamre at Hebron. This will be a super special place that we'll talk about in future episodes, where he pitched his tents. There he built an altar for the Lord. There's and so now he's like, we're going to do a little church plant. I worshiped over there between Bethel and Ai. Now I'm building an altar here, and I'm going to expand the number of places where I praise the name of God, where I feel your presence. Because after now I've walked around all this stuff, this is good stuff. And now this is going to be the place where I call on the name of the Lord. And again, you know, beating this dead horse, who's the hero of this story?
Not Abraham or Lot, for sure.
It's not Abraham, and it's not Lot. It's the Lord who's chasing after him, protecting him. And ultimately, from Abraham, he's going to make good on his promise that Abraham is going to have a son, who's 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 going to have a son on down the line. Until you get to Jesus, who will come and redeem anyone who calls upon the name of the Lord. That God who chased after Abraham will chase after us coming into this world, leaving all the wealth behind, leaving all the privilege behind, and saying, you can have it all. I'm going to a cross as a homeless man who experiences hunger and everything else. And I'm not going to build bigger barns and take advantage of all the worldly stuff. I'm setting it all aside. I'm coming into the world to put it all aside so I can win you, so that you can become the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that he will make a great nation. Because guess who are citizens of that great nations and sons of Abraham? Through faith in Christ. Nothing to do with the bloodline. Everything to do with the fact that God's fulfillment of that promise has purchased us into the family of God. And during this, he shows us how he works with broken, fallen people. Which is to say, mercifully,
yeah,
and with lots of patience, and he's always chasing and always rebuilding.
I'm just excited he sticks with messy people. That's what I love about Genesis, just the constant reminder, like, okay. Yeah.
Well, thank God.
Yeah,
we are messy people. So we're going to leave it there. Join us next time as we go into Genesis chapter 14, where we get into a little bit of a military story. We see Abraham as a warrior and Lot, who needs rescuing. And you see just the goodness of God in really, really powerful ways. So we hope you join us then. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.